Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The Eyes to the Left. Hello and welcome to Eyes to the Left, the Mirror's political podcast. My name is Jason Beattie and I'm joined today by Kevin Maguire and Nicola Bartlett. Both Kevin and Nicola are doing Dry January, so you're going to get some very sober analysis from at least two of us. And we're going to be talking about the week's political events, which started with some warning, I have to say, with the collapse of Carillion. And why is this so important, Kevin?
Well, it's a huge company in construction and contracting, delivering of services, big private sector presence, but it is also doing a lot of government work from contracting. And it delivers everything from school meals to building hospitals, running bits of prisons, massive. And it's going to be a big hit, terrible for the people who are directly employed, indirectly employed, people in small companies. But it goes right to the heart, I think, of a problem with capitalism in Britain today, and the interaction between the public sector and the private sector, which is this contracting culture, is creating these huge, giant firms which can be incredibly profitable. When they fail, it's disastrous. And it's appalling for the people who work for them and the taxpayers and the people who get those services, because this private finance initiative, which is what they're using in the public sector, it came up with 1992 in Norman Lamont, Tory treasurer. The Tories ran it. Labour should have shut it down, but instead expanded it. And it is still going on under the Conservatives now. And we're chucking good taxpayers' money after bad, normally to give fat cats huge profits in the private sector and poor value for money in the public sector. And then it will go wrong, as it has in Carillion, where they got some projects monstrously wrong.
So a big political question as well, not just the system, but this company issued three profit warnings in run up to Christmas, and the government, in the form of Chris Grayling, the Transport Secretary, I will try not to swear about him this time, he then awarded yet more government contracts to this company, which was in danger. So but whether they want to prop it up, or whether it's because they have this kind of ideological belief that private is good and public is bad.
Again, you see, all the profits go to the private sector. The public sector is bearing the risk. And he was subsidising. Grayling, given HS2 contract, high-speed 2 contract, was subsidising a failing company. And he was using public money to do that. The government's excuses, well, they insisted these were joint projects, so the firms were involved, so they would pick them up and they won't collapse completely. Well, that might be so, but we're still using public money to prop up, subsidise, protect, lie in the pockets of big private companies which don't deliver value for money. It'd be much better building your schools if you owned them yourselves. The same with hospitals, it's the same with roads.
Yeah, and the flaw in the system is that these firms bid for these state contracts, but to be competitive, they go for the lowest possible margins, and then the executives get rich, but they then squeeze the workers. You know, one of the examples of Carillion was they had a lot of 0 hours contracts, They blacklisted unions. Yeah. So but that was how they made the money. It was actually the lowest, worst possible working conditions, maximum profits, but they still couldn't make a profit out of it.
No, they got a couple of contracts that went wrong, a hospital in Birmingham, one in Liverpool, a road up in Scotland, some dodgy overseas moves in the Middle East and so on. And they make their money by running the hospitals, by running the schools, by changing the broken windows in a prison or not. And they charge the taxpayer a fortune. So I'm sure some of these Carillion contracts will just be picked up by other private companies which will cash in on them. It's just not good value for us, for taxpayers, for the public.
And Nicola, how damaging is this for Theresa May's government, do you think?
I think the sheer scale of Carillion as a company going under has just really brought home to people how much these firms like Carillion are invested in as you say, the public services that we rely on. And Theresa May and her government are very much, you know, kind of married to this company. It's doing everything, you know, even serving school dinners, every aspect of our lives. And I think the Tories are, you know, incredibly linked with what happens now. They've said that they won't bail out a failing private sector company, but in order to keep the show on the road when it comes to the public sector, they're going to have to make certain allowances, and they're going to be punished for that by people. This, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn has suggested this might be a watershed moment in terms of private companies providing public services, and maybe that's kind of wishful thinking on his part because this is an ideological position he's always held. But I think it has certainly opened people's eyes to the kind of close interaction between these companies, which, as you say, were kind of creaming off profits for the bosses. I think they only had something like a 2% profit margin, which, just from someone who knows nothing about business, sounds like a very risky endeavour altogether. So I think this really is going to hurt Theresa May a lot, I think.
Yeah, and just one last thing, you know, that they are now seen to be siding with a company where the bosses and shareholders took £400 million in dividends, yeah, and the hole in the pension scheme was £600 million. So anybody looking just as a kind of, you know, a kind of glance at how capitalism works is going to go, hang on, that's not right. Why aren't there better regulations of this? And it's not the first time, you know, this is something Jeremy Corbyn, we'll talk about PMQs in a minute, Prime Minister's question in a minute, but Jeremy Corbyn raised this, you know, in the Olympics we had G4S unable to provide the security, they had to bring in the police for the army. Then we've had the East Coast Main Line contracts, the franchises running that, First National Express had to pull out. Then they hand it back to another private consortium of Stagecoach and Virgin, which is pulling out early because it doesn't want to pay the $2 billion it bid for the contract. This keeps happening. We've had, you know, we've had Atos doing benefits. We've had, you know, all sorts of problems all the way down the line with these contracts. And yet the Tories religiously stick to it.
Well, it has us all in the public, voters, taxpayers, whatever you want to call us, citizens, subjects, if you're a monarchist. It has us all working for these private companies. These private companies are supposed to work for us. But they're just milking the system. You rattle through them, and Theresa May likes that mantra, you know, a country working for everyone. Hang on, the country's not working for everyone. We're working for Carillion and Stagecoach and G4S and Branson sitting in his tax haven. This is completely wrong. I'd love it to be a watershed moment, as Jeremy Corbyn said. I was hoping that the collapse of the banks and their nationalisation in 2008 was going to be a watershed moment, but it wasn't. They were soon back, with their snouts in the trough, getting their bonuses, and they didn't suffer as much as the people who lost their jobs because they pulled down half the economy with them, these greedily reckless banksters. It should be a watershed moment. And Jeremy Corbyn's ideally placed to represent change, represent the public, represent taxpayers, because he never went along with PFI. Labour should have shut it down rather than expanding it, but he wasn't with Tony Blair and Gordon Brown when they were expanding it. Theresa May backs it. She's just ideologically committed to this model of capitalism that is not working.
I think there's kind of several problems with the situation that we have there. I mean, PFI was seen by the Labour government as a way to get money quickly to deal with chronic underfunding of public services under the Tories. And I think the problem is nobody has made a proper case for funding these services. We kind of, in Britain, live in denial. We want world-class NHS education, but we've never discussed properly how it's going to be paid for. And the problem now is that we've actually lost the ability to provide a lot of these services in-house, because councils no longer have, they used to have building departments.
I mean, public works departments.
Yeah, councils haven't employed builders for years. They haven't even employed their own kind of occupational health for years. Most councils don't even own their housing stock. In order to completely rejig the system, it would take an incredible amount of money. And that's the problem that we have now, I think, is that you can hit out at what the situation is, but in order to kind of turn the clock back, we're going to need to have a huge rethink about how we fund it.
It would, but the public obligation now on PFI contracts is enormous. Yeah. It's hundreds of billions. We're spending a fortune now, just we're not getting good value for money. It's much better to build and own your own hospital from the start, build and own your own school from the start, build and own your own council houses from the start, rather than wasting money on some buying scheme, which just inflates prices. I think this is where it could be a war, shouldn't it? I'm not any great confidence it will be, but it should be.
And as you say, this was the kind of a perfect pulpit for Jeremy Corbyn at Prime Minister's Questions today. He used all six questions on Carillion. How do you think he did?
I actually didn't think he did that well. I was disappointed. He's had a good run. He's much better than he used to be. There was a time you were just happy if you were willing him on that he would get up, would knock his water over, drop his papers, and fall into the microphone.
So our expectations are raised.
They are, and this is look. He passionately believes in better the public sector, public service, reforming capitalism, making the country better. Fighting for people, and that PFI is bad. I just thought he let May, to some extent, off the hook. She sounded really pathetic when she said, look, the government were just the consumers, not the managers. If you're losing your job or your service is jeopardised, or you're going to lose a lot of money, you want more than that from a prime minister. I thought she was absolutely useless, but I just didn't think he pinned her down until he got going at the end, when he was talking about how PFI is a costly racket, and he mentioned the companies you raised earlier, Stagecoach, Branson and Virgin, G4S, Capita, and of course Carillion itself. But I just thought he should have nailed it better early on.
Do you agree, Nicola, that, you know, Theresa May, I thought, lacked empathy and should have shown more kind of understanding of those who are about to lose their jobs in Carillion? And if anything, Corbyn was guilty of being too passionate. He cared so deeply about this, he kind of almost couldn't quite marshal his arguments to pin the Prime Minister down. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that probably is fair. I do think, to give Corbyn credit, he was, you know, he knew exactly where to hit the Prime Minister on Carillion, and it was in terms of jobs and, you know, the ordinary people who are now suffering because of this. It's another huge story where you can get kind of bogged down in figures, and I think he kind of avoided doing that too much. The difficulty, as Theresa May was quick to point out, is that a third of Carillion's contracts were awarded under Labour, a third were under the Coalition, a third under the Tories. And I thought he could have kind of preempted that a little bit, because that was an obvious attack for her to make, and say something like, you know, we acknowledge that mistakes were made in the past, because he is so different to the Blair government and Brown government that have come before. He doesn't need to take the flak for that in a way. And I thought he could have done a little kind of defensive manoeuvre, which would maybe have protected him from losing his... He's a bit apt sometimes to lose his stride or lose his train of thought when he gets attacked, and I think that he's kind of missed an opportunity there.
Well, it's rather like Iraq she voted against. He can quite easily attack Iraq, and no one can pin it to him. No one can pin PFI to him because he voted against it and was against it from the beginning. You'll have to take the odd jibe about the last Labour government, but he'd probably share it.
Yeah, but one crime you can't hold against Corbyn is guilt of association with the Blair and Brown.
No, but he was frozen out.
So he was a much better leader of the opposition than half a Tory one.
So he can do far more convincingly than Ed Miliband ever did that. It's not been about anti-business, it's about being against business as usual. And the way business is done now does not work for most people. You can just make that forcefully. I just didn't feel he did it well enough. I thought he was more like sitting at GCE, PO, an O-level, or whatever you call him now. Whatever the exam is now that kids sit. Whatever that is. GCSE, isn't it?
Yeah.
I thought it was like sitting an exam paper on it rather than using a stage in Parliament and the country watching on TV and looking for the clips. You just go for a hammer and tongs, and you make the economic and the moral and the political case for reform.
And you could have hung some of Theresa May's own words about how capitalism and the markets aren't working around her neck, and I think he failed to do that. You know, put the pressure on the Prime Minister, you know, this is happening on your watch. You're the ones who oversee these contracts. You're the ones who fail to monitor and regulate the contracts going to Carillion. You know, all of this is your responsibility. And I think she kind of stonewalled. I thought she was a very remote, distant, slightly speak-your-weight machine answers. But it got him out of a hole, I think.
It did. He also, at one point, you get up and you're supposed to ask a question at the end, and he didn't ask a question, and she said rather smugly, "Look, I'll answer if you ask a question." Truth is, she never answers when he asks a question. Mm. But it allowed her side to cheer, and you could see the Labour side knew he dropped a clanger there. But maybe it was because he was overconfident, because he knows it inside out and backwards and forwards and so on, and he just didn't apply himself in the normal way because he thinks everybody will just agree with him. Perhaps that was the case.
It hasn't been the best of weeks for the Prime Minister, but we could say about every week. And aside from Carillion, she's also had a problem with her new vice chair of the Conservative Party. Nicola, do you want to talk us about Ben Bradley, the 28-year-old MP, Tory MP for Mansfield, who's now meant to be in charge of recruiting more young people to the Conservatives? How's his week going?
I wouldn't say he's having the best week. He's probably frantically deleting everything he's ever written on the internet currently. He was exposed for a blog post. I think he wrote it when he was 22, basically suggesting that the unemployed should have vasectomies to stop them having children, basically, which, you know, if that doesn't sound like eugenics or social cleansing, I don't know what does. He had some really kind of outrageous comments on this blog post, and basically warned that if they didn't do that, then the UK would be, I think it was, overcome with a sea of wasters.
Charming man.
Yes, lovely, lovely man. It's slightly awkward for the Prime Minister, having promoted him last week. He's also meant to be, well, he's been talking a lot recently about the Tories' digital presence and how they're not doing enough on Twitter and Facebook and so on. So he's kind of been hoisted by his own petard on that one. His back catalogue online kind of keeps coming. Today it's been revealed that he said that if public sector workers, he was basically arguing in favour of public sector pay cap. He said if public sector workers didn't like it, they should quit their jobs and do something else.
Nurses, teachers, firefighters, police officers, soldiers, council workers, social workers, housing officials, coast guards, civil servants, people in job centres. I mean, he's a Tory brat. And they presented him as their rising star.
Brat with a B.
Yeah. He's clear, he might be a shooting star and gone very, very quickly. He's not going to endear himself to young people. I think it's about 190 families with 10 or more children in the category he's adopted. Drowning in a vast sea of unemployed wasters was what he said Britain would be. Because this was the height of David Cameron and George Osborne drawing distinctions between the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. Because he wanted to draw battle lines and get low-paid workers to attack people who were unemployed and so on. It played to every base instinct, demonising and scaremongering and misrepresenting, so the Conservatives could then justify cutting the pay of nurses and teachers, reducing the in-work benefits for low-paid workers in the public and the private sectors, and bringing in benefit cuts for everybody, including those who work. The problem in Britain isn't these families, although I agree. I wonder why they want so many children, but what do you do if you cut their money? It's the children who will suffer. You're going to take them into care. It'll be far more expensive. But the problem isn't them. The problem in Britain is chronic low pay. When you've got more than half the people who are poor are actually in work, but on low wages, and now they're having their benefits cut. And it really contrasts with, there we have Theresa May making excuses, going soft on Carillion fat cats who've been subsidised and their incredible salaries by the public sector, and then we find out they turn once again on a small number of people who they demonise. They don't demonise the Carillion directors, they demonise a few people who are on benefits. And it's kind of sick, vile, bigoted, prejudiced politics.
And just to bring this full circle, one of the issues we got with Carillion is they're paying their workers so low they had to claim tax cuts.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the taxpayer was losing out anyway.
Yeah. We were subsidising
the low wages of big private firms whose bosses were making more than £1 million a year.
Yeah, a former chief who is still he's lost his job, but he's still getting £55,000 a month. Right? It's indefensible what Carillion did. And yet again, I bet you we can't unearth any attacks by this Ben Bradley on companies. I bet you will find he's always been punching down and never punching up.
Are we being unfair on politicians by kind of raking over what they said on social media and their youth or not? I mean, are we all going to have skeletons in our closet as a result of this, or do we think it's that he's bang to rights?
And unless he can show a moment where he says, "I've completely changed and I disown everything I said," then no, we may have found out the true character of this charmer.
What do you think?
I don't think 22 is actually too young to be held accountable for what you said by any means. I mean, he was clearly trying to be provocative and trying to get people to read this blog that he was writing when he was a student and trying to get involved in politics. But, you know, I can safely say that I've never made those comments online anyway. It's not a surprise to anyone that the comments we make online are still available. We knew that, you know, I'm the same age as Ben Bradley, and I think we knew that at that point as well. And I think you're right. I think when we unearth these comments, I think that may be people's true character. I mean, obviously there are people who do undergo a change, and you know, they've shown some signs of maturing or changing their opinion, but I certainly don't think we've seen any evidence of that from Mr. Bradley.
This is in Twitter veritas, so to speak, but you know, this is going to, we're seeing the true character of these people,
which
they actually probably wouldn't say in public, on a kind of larger public stage.
I mean, it may be that he doesn't hold with the, he's distanced himself obviously from these comments.
Distance himself from himself.
Yeah, it's quite a manoeuvre. But I wonder if that's the way he made them rather than the instinct behind them. I mean, there's probably a number of people in the Tory party who agree with it.
Yeah, well, I believe in redemption and people changing and going on a journey. That's all good and true, but I just can't see where he signalled he actually changed. And you get, somebody might have been a drug addict or an alcoholic or whatever and have been doing certain behaviours because they're in such a way. I mean, he may have been a certain type of Tory and he's a different type of Tory now. But where did he fork? Where did he go? He just seems to be embarrassed that he got caught.
Yeah. And there is this substantial problem for Conservatives. They're down to, they say, fewer than 70,000 members. The majority of those members are old and white.
Yeah.
And
dying.
And dying, and with quite kind of, I would say, old-fashioned views, to put it very politely. And yet these people select the Tory candidates. They will get to vote in the next Tory leadership election. That's a very small constituency to choose the next leader of the country, isn't it?
It is.
And tiny compared to what Labour's now the largest single party in Europe.
Yeah, and bigger than the Conservatives, Liberal Democrats, SNP, Plaid, Greens, and everybody else put together in the UK. But if Ben Bigot is supposed to be, as his vice chair for youth, if he's supposed to be getting youth on side, he's going to struggle now, because one thing you can say about young people is they will not like what he said. If it strikes a chord with anyone, it will be older people who have bought that propaganda and bought the caricatures. But young people won't go for that. This is going to dog him everywhere he goes.
Huge mistake by Theresa May. She should have gone with somebody younger, more in touch with young people, like Jacob Rees-Mogg, obviously.
Yeah.
Who amazingly has a very popular Instagram page. So he's doing his bit for Tories
on his people. He understands new media better than anybody else.
Met with I'm a Celebrity Winner Toff the other week.
But Jacob Rees-Mogg, aren't people just rubbernecking? It's rather like driving past a motorway park. Up, you slow down and you look at it and you want to see what this old phobia has said now.
Very quickly, we're talking about party membership. We had the results of the election for Labour's National Executive Committee. This is the what they call the kind of a main governing body for the Labour Party, in charge of its rules, elections, etc. The three new places created, of which they all went to supporters of Jeremy Corbyn, including the Momentum's John Lansman. Now, this has caused a little bit of kind of upset amongst some of the Labour Party members and the MPs. They're a bit worried about the consequence of this. Should they be afraid, Kevin? Is this Corbyn tightening his grip on the Labour Party?
I think yes, but I don't think they should be afraid. I think it was a good argument for the members and the constituents to get extra seats. They had six. They've now got 9. That's what a 39 member body, because membership has mushroomed to more than 500,000. And they won, the left slate won all 6 seats that were up last time, last year. So you would have expected them to win the 3 again, but they're still in a minority. And they're not the militant tendency the way they are often portrayed. And yes, they will want to bring in mandatory re-selection, which would mean you have to automatically ask people to challenge your local MP rather than at the moment trigger ballots where an MP can just be re-adopted unless the local party wants to get them out or wants to have a look at somebody else. But I think you can just see how it's going. Labour is really at root, at the grassroots, a party that should and is from the bottom up. So you would expect members to have more say over candidates, more say in the NEC, more say on the policies, more say in the leader, as they now do. And I think some people just have to relax a bit.
And what about you, Nicola? What do you think of these changes? It seems quite insignificant, but it could upset the kind of harmony within the Labour Party since the general election. But it seems you've got an understanding between kind of the opponents of Jeremy Corbyn and his supporters. That a lot of the tension and backbiting seemed to have kind of dissipated, and now this seems to be in danger of it stirring it all up again or not?
Yeah, I think that's the main concern, is that there had been a kind of almost a truce since the general election between maybe warring factions is too strong, but different people of different views within the Labour Party. I think to a certain extent Kevin's right that people do need to sort of calm down. Personally, I'm really against mandatory re-selections. I don't see the point of them. It's already up to the local party to trigger it if they want, and that's who it should be up to. The local party knows who will represent their area best. And I also worry about the amount of work this is going to create for the regional offices within the Labour Party. There's a lot of bureaucracy goes into selections. But I think, you know, it's kind of incumbent on all sides at the moment to kind of have a different way of speaking to one another. I mean, especially Landsman, who, you know, is incredibly respected within the Labour movement, I would say, overall. But he's got to maybe give a little bit to assuage some of these fears from some of the more moderates. I think there is potential to kind of, you know, Labour came through that really nasty period, and that surprising result at the general election kind of gave it opportunity for the party to kind of reconcile each other. And if people retreat to their comfortable factions, and there is a danger that whole kind of antipathy between groups will be resurrected. But I don't think it has to be this way. I think there is an opportunity for it to be a really cohesive force.
I never see Landsman as a bogeyman, as some MPs did. Actually, I think during the 1980s and the Bennite battles, when he was a big supporter of Tony Benn, I think he was very sectarian then. I don't think he is sectarian now. I think he's older and wiser, although, and it wasn't just Momentum, other people did it on the Labour NEC too, removing Anne Black as chair of the disputes panel and replacing her with Christine Shawcroft was an error, because I think Anne Black was very, very straight. She was on the left, always been on the left. I remember the Blairites hating her. And she would be very, very objective. I don't want to smear Christine Shawcroft, who I think was smeared straight off by some of her opponents, claiming she'd voted to drop inquiries into anti-Semitism, which wasn't true. But I think Momentum and its supporters have to be a little careful. Otherwise, you're just going to appear to be as intolerant as some of the people who used to denounce in the past when the Blairites were on top.
Really interesting stuff, and I agree with you on Anne Black, who was always, I thought, one of the nicest people to deal with.
Big in unison, yeah.
Yeah, thank you very much for listening. We'll be back again next week. Please go to mirror.co.uk, where you can listen to the podcast, and you can subscribe and leave reviews, hopefully not too negative. My name is Jason Beattie. You can follow me at Twitter at JBeattieMirror. Kevin is on Twitter.
Kevin_Maguire.
And Nicola.
Nicola R. Bartlett.
We'll be back soon. And we've got 2 special guests lined up in the next couple of weeks, so it should be interesting. Thank you very much.